The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome to another Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, it's all about the cut and the stitch as I meet the subject of a revealing new documentary, A Man's Story. The great British fashion designer Oswald Boateng, OBE, who became the subject for filmmaker Varon Bonikos, tracing his professional and personal life over 12 years. And I speak to Argentinian director Pablo Trapero about Carancho, where the streets of Buenos Aires are the setting for a crunching drama of traffic accidents and insurance scams. I'll also be joined by Guardian film critic Zan Brooks to review some of this week's post-Oscar releases, including Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd in Wanderlust and Austrian director Markus Schleitzer's disturbing film Michael. Yes, it's the Bespoke podcast, tailor-made for the discerning cinephile since 2007. It's Film Weekly. Oswald Boateng is a designer whose public persona is very much tied to his brand of men's clothes. A striking figure, Oswald's suits have dressed A-listers such as Jamie Foxx, Richard Branson, Lawrence Fishburne and Paul Bettany. The first black tailor in London's Savile Row by the age of 28, Boateng is celebrated internationally for merging the best of British tailoring with a distinct African colour palette influenced by his Ghanaian heritage. Now a new documentary about his life emerges, following him through fashion show highs and personal life lows, and in a way, opening out the menswear material to reflect on masculinity in the modern age. The film was shot over 12 years by his friend and filmmaker Varon Bonikos. A Man's Story is a complex examination of a great British designer.
So you have an English understanding of what that is. You know you're African, you know your roots are. On the other hand, you're not being accepted because you're black. But there was a massive cultural tension, massive. Because you were in a minority, you were assuming you were alone. The riots demonstrated that you weren't alone. Your other took a very radical position. He said, I'm black and it's a real problem in life. Or I'm black, it's difficult, but I'm going to make it work. So you had to park the colour as an issue and just get on with it.
Well, I'm thrilled to say that I've got Oswald Boateng and Varon Bonikos here together. They made A Man's Story together. Varon, you're the man who followed Oswald Boateng around for 12 years, like a flea in his ear, like a fly on his wall. I mean, he's a very charismatic gentleman, very well-dressed. What about you? I mean, you're not quite up to his standards, but it must have rubbed off because, you've scrubbed up nicely.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well, yes, I mean, Oswald's probably one of the best dressed men in the world. I think in his sleep, he always looks amazing. So that was, but it wasn't really about that. And, you take the clothes away and everything. A Man's Story is really, it's what it says. It is the story of a man, and it's a story that applies to so many men, where they try and balance their life, their work life, their love life, all of these different elements to try and achieve their goal. And when they get there, it may not be enough, and they keep going. So the fashion, which Oswald's amazing at, was just the backdrop to the story of a guy over 12 years.
But watching this film, Oswald, and you're aware of this passing of time in this film. I was very aware of that. It was a film that, in a way, was being cut around you, like a yeah, suit, like sure. In the way the editors used to have scissors. This was being tailor made around you. It was a cloth that you were growing into, and it was a film that was kind of growing around you.
No, and you're right about that, because there was no plan. Mm. So, it was just, Varon just filming a series of moments of my life. So you've said it perfectly. It was just, at the end of it, was just cut round on this journey of this man. And these are the things that happened in his life. And the end result of that is, well, what do you think of a man's life? What does it all mean? What are we all striving for? And I think it's a film that speaks to many different men, I kind of said, even if you're like a president of a country or you're stacking fruit in a supermarket into a bag, you all had the same issues. either the girlfriend or the wife, work, I want more money, you know, there's problems paying something, yeah. or, you know, so those issues are all the same. And that's what I think Brian successfully achieves yeah. in the film.
In a way, it's quite painful because, as you say, you you go through a couple of divorces yeah. in this film. You have children, a couple of business failures. Yeah. You have the theft of a collection. Yeah. You have collections where some of my favourite bits of the film are where you present a collection, go out and do the whole kind yeah. of, hey, I'm yeah. cool, I'm Oswald. You come backstage and go, God, that was awful.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, no, and that's exactly, the, I mean, the thing about it is there's a lot that happens backstage on the fashion show. So you have all this amazing energy up front, but there can be absolute chaos and mayhem backstage. And I think what the film again does, it does show that kind of interesting duality of an event like that. And I think that's basically what life is.
The thing about Oswald is, and he can talk about this so third party, which is amazing because he is a brand, so he can see himself third party yeah. often. But he is very honest, and you can tell, you know, by the film. And he never once kind of was not honest with me or the camera. And I think when he came to see the film, that was one of the things that came across. And the second part of that is belief. So honesty and belief are two of those things. And I like that. It's like the way he deals with life is he deals with it head on. I tend to bury this stuff right. and pull it out later, but he deals with it at the time.
It's interesting because I said to you before that I like the film. The guy that plays you yeah, is really good. But the point being that it must be difficult because there are moments where you, obviously, and you know when the camera's yeah. following you, who are you going to be in this film? And you're quite famous for being quite upfront. Yeah. You're all about the front, yeah. the clothes, yeah. the sparkle, the kind of the right. costume, if that's you like, right. to right. peel off the layers and be naked and vulnerable and emotional without acting. There must have been a time where there were different layers of register going on.
No, I think because he filmed over such a long period, you know, so there came a point where I just forgot about him. And the way he filmed, he's quite gifted in his filming, which is a lot of time I just wouldn't see him.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned to the people that you're dressing, and you know you've done the Oscars. There's Will Smith, yeah. there's Jamie Foxx for Ray and
Day-Lewis. Yeah, I mean, you know, Ray Winston's in it. Paul Bettany.
Yeah, I mean that takes me back to you doing Gangster Number One, yeah. addressing British designers and British. It's a strong tie for British film, but they seem to forget for the. There's a lot of costume designers that are women, Sandy Powell, etc. Yeah. But we don't kind of. It doesn't seem that the male designers are used enough in the movies.
No, and I think you're right about it. I mean, there's a real great platform here for the movies that we make here, British films, to be more stylish than what they are, because we have got some great talent. I just think a lot of the time is I think most of the directors are so busy trying to find the budgets for the films that they sometimes maybe lose sight of some easy wins on the ground here. But I think...
But it's good for you guys, your design. I mean, like Tom Ford, when he did A Single Man, I mean, yeah. he dressed everyone, from Colin Firth to Julianne Moore as well. It's a great launch pad.
No, for me, I can't wait to do more clothing for films. So I've always wanted to do James Bond.
Yeah.
Always, you know. I've always
just tailoring.
Yeah, I've always done the bad guy. I want to do James. So at some point, I'm hoping that they're going to return James back to Savaro and I get a chance.
Do you think that's because you've got that gangster look? I mean, it's sort of, you know, classic English tailoring, but with a dash of African potentate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, whatever the dash of African potency, because James Bond goes everywhere in the world and fits in, which is always the coolest thing about it. He's in the middle of the desert, some obscure language, and somehow he understands and can speak that language. So he is that guy. Yeah. So if anyone can be wearing Botang, it is definitely James.
Yeah. Well, has movies been an inspiration to you? I noticed in one of your Givenchy shows you use a manga cartoon
Exactly.
Have they always been, what icons have always been influential on you?
No, because I'm a big lover of film. So I've always, my first ever fashion show that I did way back in Paris during Men's Week, back in 94, I made a short film as an invitation. And it was back then, it's a VHS tape. And basically, the short film basically was about me going to Paris in the back of a taxi, and my collection was in a trunk. And kind of that was kind of more or less what it was. And I filmed the experience, and I sent that out as the invite, and I had a huge response, and it was a big launch pad for me, and I got my first deal that I did in Japan. So film has always been the language of how to communicate my creativity. So I've always showed these short films, 3-5 minutes up front, to set the tone of the emotion, and the basis of the collection, because you can't beat film for the immediacy of installing an emotion in an audience.
And who was your, I mean, as a filmic influence growing up, was there, is it a Steve McQueen thing? Do you have a Sean Connery and James Bond, as you mentioned?
I think it's a mixture. So, you know, James Bond, Sean Connery, for sure. A little bit of The Persuaders and this, you know, with, and what's that?
Roger Moore and Moore. Tony Curtis.
Tony Curtis, really, very much loved them in that. The Saint. Mm-hmm. Little bit of The Saint, dash of The Saint, and then the great movies, Italian Job, Thomas Crown Affair, and Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Right.
Man from, great. So, you know, you kind of got this selection. That's my childhood. Right. You know, so it's late 60s.
And you know they inform the cut of your future play.
Well, the thing is they it was a statement of cool that they had that really was in terms of cut, they need to cut quite straight and short. I cut with a waist. So in terms of actual cutting, my cut is very different. The only relationship that is really probably similar is the length of the trouser and the narrowness of the trouser. But outside of that, it's I've always looked at more a sculptured shape than as opposed to a straight line.
Yours has got a feminine feel to that masculinity.
Absolutely, because I'm about creating, you know, beautiful clothes for men, and you know, I actually design clothes for men that women will actually come to you and go, "You look beautiful in that suit." I actually go with that intent.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful-looking film. There's a lot of beautiful people in beautiful clobber in it, of course. But it is a very moving film as well, with a handsome film star in it, Varun. Well done in casting him, because he's very good. And I found it a much more affecting film than I thought. It isn't a film about clothes, but it is about a film of what makes a man. So congratulations on that, Varun Bonny. Thanks for coming up.
Thank you for having me.
And Oswald Boateng, a pleasure as ever.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
A huge thanks to Oswald Boateng and Varun Bonny-Koss there. A Man's Story is on general release here in the UK from Friday the 9th of March. Every girl indeed crazy about a sharp-dressed man, so I'm joined by Guardian critic Zan Brooks. Is that a bit of Oswald Boateng you're wearing there, or is that a bit of Burton?
It's a bit of Mr. Byright, I think, as is my wont.
Zan, this week, nice to have you back. Well done for staying up all night throughout the Oscars, live blogging. Mm. It was all you needed. Woke up in the morning, read Zan Brooks. That's what I like to hear.
Thank you. Yeah, who needs to actually sit through 5 hours of it when I can splurge it all in a bunch of words?
Well, you did it very well.
Via the medium of the internet.
Yes, well done. But this week we've also been watching some other films, because it's not just about the Oscars. We will recap a little bit on the Oscars, Sam. But we've got to talk about Wanderlust, which stars Jennifer Aniston and her current beau, Justin Theroux. Michael, the Austrian film, which is very controversial, we'll talk about. Well, I'll get your opinion on Carrancho, if I may, as well. I am going to talk to Pablo Trapero, the director of that film, as well. So we'll see if that's worthwhile. And then we'll just recap a bit of the Oscars. So we'll start with Wanderlust, which finds Jennifer Aniston and her husband, George, played by Paul Rudd, wanting to settle the bill after a night staying with the hippies, led by Alan Alda.
Did you take credit cards?
No. We all decided that you paid us last night with your friendship and honesty and your stories.
That's so
kind.
Do we get change back?
And you know what? If we didn't need the money so badly, we would insist.
Mm. Just remember, money buys nothing.
Yep. Mm.
Well, nothing important, right?
No. Money literally buys nothing.
I think you mean metaphorically.
No, literally, nothing.
Ooh. Literally, money buys most things.
No, nothing. Right? Are you saying that?
Well, I'm saying that literally,
I'm saying literally money buys nothing.
Oh, Zan, the delights of non-economy. Would you trade your life for some mung beans to live with a bunch of hippies?
I think I would if Alan Alda was there. I'd watch Alan Alda in any old rubbish. I just have.
And luckily you do, because he is often in rubbish these days. If it bends, it breaks, I kept thinking. If it breaks, it's not funny.
Yeah,
That's the line from...
But he doesn't quite equal that here.
No.
And he's very much a sort of secondary character in this, playing second fiddle to obviously Jennifer Aniston as the hipster New York documentary filmmaker, and Paul Rudd as her outsourced Wall Street husband, who wash up in the hippie commune after a little detour to the McMansion in Georgia with Paul Rudd's brother,
who runs a toilet business.
And that they wash up at the hippie commune, and it's sort of Martha May was it Martha May, Stephen Duane?
Yeah.
But without the threat.
Isn't Alan Alda in Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice? No, he's in The Four Seasons, isn't he?
He is, but he's also in that great David O. Russell film, Flirting with Disaster, yeah, where he plays a similar character,
yeah, there.
The sort of the hippie on the lam.
The come down from the Catskills. It's a bit Taking Woodstock. It's a bit Martha, Marcy May, Marlene.
Yeah, it is. And yet about 8 shades lighter.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but it is like shooting fish in a barrel, isn't it, this?
Because what? Because hippies are easy, easy target?
Yeah, exactly. Haven't people been poking fun at hippies since like 1970?
Yeah, I think they have.
So, you know, 40-odd years on, you think, well, surely there's got to be something new to say. And there's not. They just, you know, hippies go nude and that's funny. They like free love and that's funny. They drink acid tea and that's hilarious. And it's just all the cliches kind of wheeled out again.
Aren't they? Yeah. And it's a Jennifer Aniston movie. So in some way it must kind of tick off all the kind of I'm a professional woman kind of thing. But yet I can also look kind of hot in my hippie gear. There's that kind of fashion.
Exactly.
Thing.
I think that's in the contract, isn't it? And it definitely ticks all those boxes. And it's a sort of Paul Rudd movie as well.
As well.
Paul Rudd is one of these people that, I don't know, I find there's something a little bit creepy about him. I mean, he's too clean cut, isn't he? He's
like
a slight American Psycho.
But he's supposed to be the you and me, the guy kind of...
He's not me, he might be you.
He's a bit more me, actually, yeah.
Yeah. I'm more Alan Alda in the wheelchair.
Moaning about the friends that he used to have in 1970.
It was okay.
It's all right, isn't it? It's a bit mixed, isn't it? Because it doesn't quite know if it's a satire on current society. Like,
yes,
you know, let's go into the hippies because, you know, modern
because
New York
we're all
is,
going to hell in a handcart.
Exactly, yeah. We're all going to be let go. And
or should we just laugh at these ridiculous people?
Yeah.
And so it tries to have it both ways.
Yeah, it does. And that sort of doesn't work. So in a way, there were bits of it that I thought were quite funny and some funny lines. That said, I was thinking, couldn't you have been easily been a smarter comedy?
Well, it's very lazy, isn't it? I mean, if you're poking fun at the hippies, it falls into the trap of all the hippie cliches just lying around telling the same old stories and the same old jokes again and again.
Yeah.
So there's very little rigour here. It's perfectly amiable. And I think after a heavy Oscar night, it was a nice kind of palliative.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, like a mild reefer high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you perhaps you don't know what that's like, but I assume. But apparently,
I've read about
that. I've read about
stuff,
that's what
it
is. I thought the actual trip scene with the tea was much better than the one in Taking Woodstock, which was all kind of like Jefferson Airplane and kind of a bit cliche. This one actually felt quite good.
Yes, it did, didn't it? It's directed by David Wayne, who produced obviously by Judd Apatow, inevitably.
Yeah.
David Wayne did Role Models,
which
again,
I liked.
With Paul Rudd, which I thought was better.
That was really funny.
That was really smart.
That was about men who can't grow up and who kids.
Yeah, and they get kind of community service order and have to look after to kids, and it had a proper rough and tumble quality to it, which this really doesn't have.
No, I thought they gave up on this. Well, they're probably too stoned to finish it, rather. this is Justin Theroux, who is going out with Jennifer Aniston now.
Yes, you say this, and I didn't know that until I looked to you for my source of celebrity gossip.
There's not much else to think about. So
I suppose not. He's the hirsute hippie guru,
yes,
who teaches her how to milk an udder and then says, you've got to lick the tip. No, lick the tip, which I thought was quite funny.
Yeah, there were bits of where I was reduced to sort of silly giggles. So that is Wanderlust, and as you say, it was after a long night at the Oscars. This will not be troubling the Academy next year, I
suspect not. I mean, but who knows? If the year is as bad as it might be, this could be next year's Best Picture winner.
Exactly. Let's move to a film that did trouble an awards jury in some way, because Michael was a competitor in competition at Cannes last year, directed by the Austrian Markus Schleinzer. It tells the story of Michael, who works in an insurance office, but each night the blinds come down on his ordinary suburban home and we find that he's actually keeping a little child locked in his basement. Zan, the sort of asceticism of this film is that we're not going to play any clips. The poster is just a blank saying Michael. I thought perhaps it was an homage to Michael Haneke, the Austrian who clearly Markus Schleinzer is in awe of. Does he have the kind of icy stare to match the Austrian master?
Yeah, he does. I think he actually worked with Haneke.
He
was a casting director, and this is his first film, is
it?
So it's very much in the Haneke mould, and it's very much in the Ulrich Seidel mould, and it's that sort of Austrian chill, and this sort of affectless tale of the mundanity of evil, I guess. The character of Michael, played by Michael Fruth, is an office drone, and it's really is the monster as absence, as automaton, I suppose. He you see him sort of pootering around, and he's slightly peevish, and he's at work, he's slightly peevish, and then at home he's slightly peevish, but occasionally will call the little boy out of the cellar, and they'll sit and watch TV together, and then
Wolfgang.
And then there's a sort of suggestion of other stuff going on, but with great admirable restraint. It doesn't go into any
really
of that.
Admirable. I mean, he washes his dick in a sink.
He washes his dick, but you don't actually see where the dick's been before that.
No, but I mean,
which I think safeguards it against galloping exploitation. I suppose.
Well, does it though? I mean, is that any better, that restraint, than, say, Last House on the Left, where we just see sort of, you know, or Texas Chainsaw, where we see them kind of
I think it is, because it demystifies the thing of evil being something that's proactive, something of glamour. And I think that those films tread a much more dangerous course, because they, by the nature of film, they force you into an identification with the perpetrator. And this doesn't. This sucks the life out of everything.
See, normally, I think they're from the victim's point of view, most of those films. That we are the American teenager trapped in the box. We are the one tied down who we don't want evil to
happen
to.
I think the killer is always more glamorous than the killed.
Yeah, but so you identify with the killer.
Maybe it's just something between me and my psychiatrist that I need to go into this.
So, because I thought this one is definitely from the point of view of Michael,
It is from the point of view of Michael. And yet, what's interesting here is that you've got the monster as absence, but you've also got the innocent victim as a kind of absence himself, in that he's by definition, being a 10-year-old boy in this situation, he's passive, and he is basically going through the motions of a kid in a family setup.
Yeah, well,
however warped this family setup is, that's his touchstone.
But Michael keeps telling him that his dad doesn't want him anymore, that he's his new dad. He's kidnapped this boy, and he's keeping him. So the boy is becoming used to this, as a 10-year-old might, to this experiment, like a mouse trapped in a cage.
Yeah.
But the boy does try to escape.
And the boy is growing older. And that is the tension of the film, that he is becoming more and more aware of the situation he's in and kicking against it. And one of the great moments is where the boy does a Christmas card for Michael and draws the two figures, him and Michael, the same height, the same age. And it's like this great attack on what Michael wants, which is just the kid to stay a little kid.
You have some art house admiration for the icy detachment, the Austrian Germanic detachment of this film.
I think I probably do, yes. Mm. I thought that this was a really good piece of work.
I hate this film.
You hated it.
I think it should be just thrown away and just stuck in a dustbin. If you're going to do a film from the point of view of a paedophile, you have to explain more. I don't think you have any right to just kind of go, well, here he is, he's a paedophile. He fucks this 10-year-old boy, washes his cock in a sink, and gets on with making the dinner. And that's fine. It's not fine. You have to sort of say, well, this is good or this is bad. And then he just gets, you know, I'm not going to give a spoiler, because then no one should see this film, but then there is a peremptory kind of sort of justice meted out anyway.
I don't think that you do need to. I think that's actually an arrogance explain why and how. I think that the most depressing thing about acts of great cruelty and evil is the industrial nature of it, the fact that it's a process, and that people arrange their lives, and this man is very neat and has his little life all kind of mapped out, and that is what is chilling about it. That's the message that I got, not that, oh, he must have been abused as a child.
I don't want any backstory on that. But I do want some explanation as to his motivation for why he is doing that. He knows he is evil. He knows he is wrong. He knows he is morally
What motivation could he possibly give you?
Well, I want to just watch. This is it. Oh, we're all like this. Just to all beware every insurance clerk. They've all got all behind all those Austrian windows. Lurks a paedophile or a Hitler. I don't get it. I just don't think that's clever. Haneke, I think, is brilliant. Using the same techniques, but you identify with far more with each character, whether it be Wolfgang or Michael. In this, the chilly kind of, I don't know, it just seemed blankly idiotic, in fact, of what was going on.
I would agree that it's blank. I don't think it's idiotic. And I think that there's something to be said for just showing the machinations of this world without the context, without the scope.
Would you see this or Best Exotic Marigold Hotel?
I think they're both pure evil in their way.
That's what I was hoping. I'd love to see a double bill. Someone goes, oh, I can't get into Best Exotic. I'll go to screen 6 at the High Wycombe Odeon and then end up seeing Michael. I think it's a very poisonous and dangerous piece of work, personally.
Okay.
But no one's going to see it, so it's not that dangerous.
It.
So it doesn't really matter.
And it's certainly troubling.
Yeah, that certainly
is. We can agree on that.
It is horrible. Zan, the Buenos Aires night is also horrible, it seems. Traffic accidents are the number one cause of death of the under 35, says a caption at the beginning of Pablo Trapero's new film, Carrancho. We'll be talking to Pablo a little bit later, but first, let's hear from his wife, Martina Guzman, playing Luján, dealing with an emergency on the streets of Buenos Aires.
¿Qué pasó?
Parece que se paró delante de la camioneta, lo... Se golpeó muy fuerte la cabeza, no tenía puesto el casco.
¿Sabes si está borracho?
El alcohol no tiene.
¿Sabes cómo se llama?
Creo que Gustavo.
Now, do you drive?
I do drive.
Would you drive in Buenos Aires?
I really would not drive, or I wouldn't even walk across the street in Buenos
That's
Aires.
The worst
8,000 people a year going under the wheels. But fortunately, you've got Ricardo Darín as Sosa, the vulture, who's the personal injury huckster, who's on hand to either help these people or to effectively throw them under the wheels in terms of sort of insurance scams that he's running.
Yeah, there are juggernauts here at play that are both institutional and literal on the road.
Yeah, and the sense that he is the vulture, but the definite implication is that he's as much preyed on as everybody else, and that the system is the vulture.
Yeah, well, he certainly is trapped in the system.
He's totally trapped, as is the hospital doctor. Played by Martina Guzman, who he falls in love with. And it is a story of people living on the edge and just steeped in corruption, I guess.
A strange love affair they strike up, isn't it? Because, I mean, their idea of a first date seems to be counting cars running red lights.
Yes, well, you know, if you're in Buenos Aires at the moment, maybe that's what you do. And it's a film that plays out on the streets at night and has this great tawdry, seedy exoticism to it. I think that Pablo Trapero made Leonera a couple of years ago.
In a woman's prison.
And I think that he is a really stylish filmmaker.
Yeah, I agree.
And this is a bit of hard-boiled social realism with a social conscience and with something to say. And yet, it's properly cinematic as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it kind of reminded me of Bringing Out the Dead.
Yes, it
Scorsese's,
did. Yeah.
And a bit of Crash, the Cronenberg, in a way, because of the traffic. And plus also The Rainmaker. It's got that kind of, you know, little kind of, I love those, like a noirish kind of lawyer story as well going on.
Yeah. No, I thought this was very good indeed.
That's Carancho. We'll hear from Pablo Trapero in a bit. Just before we do that, Zan, I just want to get your blurry insights into having survived the night of the Oscars. Strange, the Oscars this year. Even though I love The Artist, and I've loved it since May, as we know, anyone who listens to the show knows that we both like the film. Mm. It's one of my favourite Best Picture winners for years.
Is it now? Yeah, it may be my favourite since No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, you like that too.
I really like that. Yeah, but again, because it's won everything, the suspense was notable by its absence, wasn't it?
Do we know too much now? It used to be, I don't know if this was because I wasn't a film critic and I was just growing up, but it used to be that the Oscars was this kind of almost pantheon, and you never could work out what was going to win. It was a big surprise, Joan Crawford in a dress or whatever it was, Meryl Streep in Sophie's Choice. Now, is it the science too exact that we know from Critics Circle Awards, SAG Awards, PGA Awards, who's going to win?
I think so. And I think if we do, then there's a good chance that most other people do as well, because there's just so much coverage. It's just kind of carpet bombed in the months leading up to it. I remember doing my predictions and almost going out on a limb and saying, you know, there's got to be one or two surprises. And I got it wrong, because there weren't any surprises at all, really. Possibly Midnight in Paris winning Best Original Screenplay.
No, I thought it was
a very minor surprise, but, you know, I went with that as well. And yeah, it was a strange event, wasn't it? It felt like being entertained on a cruise liner, where you had Billy Crystal doing his kind of old school song and dance, a bit of blackface in there.
Yeah, lovely. Don't see enough of that minstrelsy.
And a bit of song, bit of dance. It was made, the theatre was made up like this old time Nickelodeon.
Oh, yeah. And that Cirque du Soleil stuff.
Cirque du Soleil doing their homage to North by Northwest and things like that. Very odd and not unpleasant.
No.
I was sitting there thinking, this is all, you know, very, very kind of, you know, calm and soothing. And yet you think, but is that what it's supposed to be? And there was a sense that, where is film going? It felt so cosy and so bolting the doors.
But
and
here was this theatrical production about film.
Yeah.
And all the films this year were celebrating old films.
Old films and old actors. And, you know, let's not get ageist here. And it's great to see Christopher Plummer win. It's great to see Meryl Streep win. It was a fantastic performance. But there was definitely a sense of, you know, things ain't what they used to be, but they are here. You know, because we're still in 1929.
Well, we have talked about Carancho, we've talked about Michael, we've talked about, you know, a Jennifer Aniston comedy. All cinema is there, it's just not there at the Oscars.
It's
perhaps
just not there, and the Oscars has become like, you know, that cliche of the dying star, that the light reaches you 12 months later, and that is the Oscars. It's all over But the Oscars is just this kind of little glimmer that gets possibly too much attention now.
Good. For more coverage of the Oscars, go to guardian.co.uk, where there's loads of it. Sam, we shall leave that for another year. Thank you very much indeed. And the award for best stamina certainly goes to yourself.
Thank you. Best stammer as well.
Now, just then you heard Zan and me discussing Pablo Trapero's Carancho. It was, in fact, Argentina's official selection for Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars this year. Sadly, not shortlisted, but it did have a tremendously successful life on the festival circuit, playing at Cannes and London, of course, to great acclaim. And I'm delighted that Pablo can be on the line now from Buenos Aires to discuss the film further. You made it through the traffic then this morning, Pablo.
Oh, I'm okay.
Is it really as dangerous, the traffic situation in Buenos Aires?
It's not an easy driving city, but it's changing slowly, but it's something that's happening around. But sometimes you have the feeling that you could lose your life in around the corner, and because there's really crazy drivers. Not just in Buenos Aires, but in the country in general.
Yeah, road movies were something you liked because you did the La Familia Rodante. What's that called in English? The traveling
family.
Yeah, which was about a family who lived on the road as well.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's obviously something that's very much in your mind.
Yeah, actually, I could tell that my father has a car shop supplies, so I grew up in an environment of with cars and everything all in my family. So maybe it's because of that.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly why. It's when you say it's right.
This is a road movie, set in Buenos Aires. It's not about the travelling. It's about the society that has grown up, I suppose, around the culture of roads, which is probably where you, as a director, are from. As you say, you grew up in cars.
I like the idea of movement in general. I mean, and when you talk about movies, you talk about movement. And when you talk about characters, again, you talk about characters moving from A to B or whatever. I mean, drama is always something about movements and movings and whatever. And I like the idea of that. And if you think that movies are, for me, before drama, images, I always prefer to think what it's going on in terms of image. But, of course, thinking about image, hard to explain that, but the movement of the frame should be the drama, you know, should mm-hmm. be the essence of that.
Pablo, you obviously in this film, you work with your wife, Martina Guzman, again. How is it to work with her? Because she was fantastic for you in the Lion's Den as well. She's a wonderful, in this film. Is she in your next film? Do you always work together? Is it something that now you only, you know, work with her? You have a great relationship, clearly, on screen. I don't know how you are off screen. I hope as well.
Listen, before that, I never work again with the same actor. You know, it was the first time I decided to go again. I mean, to work again with somebody, and it is because we really feel good on set, and you know, as a director, it's not that easy to get that complicity with an actor. Mm-hmm. Now we just finished another movie that I'm in post production right now, and I work again with Ricardo Darín. Great in Carancho, but also we work very good, and we became friends after that. And I like, you know, I used to work with people from film school time, you know, and. But with actors, it changed because, of course, we need to move to somewhere else in terms of, again, image and framing. And when you repeat actors, sometimes it's not helping to the movie. But at the moment, I feel good with this society and the screen, and we really feel good working on it. You know, in the sets and developing the character before and shooting and everything. And in the next movie, that is called Elefante Blanco, that I'm working on.
Elefante Blanco.
We work again, Martina, Ricardo, Darín.
And what does that mean in English, Pablo?
White elephant.
Ah, Elefante Blanco. Sí.
Elefante Blanco. Sí. It's the name of a building that it used to be a big hospital in the 50s, and the construction was interrupted, and it became a kind of a slum area around the place.
Absolutely. So, well, I look forward to. I hope that will this film be finished in time for Cannes? That's where we normally see you.
I mean, we are in post right now, and the producers are willing to be there, but who knows? We are still on track. I mean, I'm right now in post production, so maybe in a month, maybe we will have kind of feedback from them.
Yeah, well, we wish you the best of luck. I'll come and see you in Cannes, of course. Always good to see you and Martina Guzman. She's very good on red carpet, your wife. Do tell her that
okay.
For me. Pablo, muchas gracias. Thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on Carancho. I liked it very much. Me encanta.
Thank you very much for your call, and I hope we'll keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. See you.
Okay.
Gracias to Pablo Trapero, and Carancho is on general release here in the UK from this Friday, the 2nd of March. And that's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is Thomas Newman's Indian-infused score to current hit The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Remember, for the inside track on the film industry, do pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer for my Trailer Trash column and the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, we'll see you next week. Bye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.